stay tuned for The Lynn Show. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with singer and voice teacher Carlo Thomas. If there's anything you can do with your voice, Carlo has not only done it, but taught dozens and dozens and dozens of others to do it and to make a living doing it. Listen to this extraordinary man talk about an extraordinary career and a delightful life. Hang on, here comes the show.
Hearing from an inner voice, finding choice where there's no choice, with gentle prodding from
welcome to The Lynn Show. The Lynn Show is about being who you really are and living the life you were really meant to live. I talk about why we are not all who we really are and we are not all living the life we are meant to live, and what you can do to recover, to recapture some of what you might have had to hide so that you can live the life you were really meant to live. In addition to talking about that, I play interviews with people who make their living or their life with an art. I do that because it's so difficult to make a living in this culture or even to give parts of your life to an art, so that the people who do it really are who they were meant to be, and you can hear it in their interviews. Today, I'm playing an interview I did with Carlo Thomas, who has given an entire life to music in every way that you possibly can, not only as a performer himself in every possible venue, but as a teacher, beginning at the age of 14, where he wanted to give away what he was getting to others. And he's still doing it. He's still giving away everything that he knows and enhancing the lives of everyone who comes into contact with him. I'm not going to say any more about this because this is a long interview and I didn't want to cut any of it. So if you want to hear what it sounds like to be who you really are, just stay tuned and listen to Carlo Thomas. I am here with Carlo Thomas in his home-come studio, and I have come to interview Carlo because he's so spectacular. So
I'll just explain. I interview people who make their living or their life with an art. And the art to which you have clearly given your life is music/singing. Is that correct?
That's right.
That's good. Good, I got that right. Okay. And so I only ask one question.
Okay.
And that is, how did it start? When was the very first moment in your life that you thought that music was important, or that you wanted to sing, or that you could sing, or that people liked to listen to you, or any of that?
When I was 3 years old, I learned to read.
Mm-hmm. Really?
And we listened to the Metropolitan Opera. And one of the first things I heard was a soprano who sang Queen of the Night. And I decided I was enchanted with Queen of the Night. So that became my song, which I did at the drop of a hat on a dairy farm.
I see. At three.
At three. And I could peel paint with my voice. And I had all the notes.
Really?
I could sing the F above high C. But nobody thought much about it because everybody else could do the same thing.
Is that true?
It's true.
In your family?
My mother could sing everything. My sister could sing everything. We sang. That was what we did. We sang for Christmases. We sang for Easter. We got together, and that was what we did. I'm of Welsh descent, and we sang. Nobody thought much of it because everybody sang.
Okay, so you're saying that you didn't think of it as a career or a
vocation? Not at that point. It was just that I heard the music, and I could hear it and mimic it. And I could
immediately.
Yeah, there was there wasn't anything.
What's so interesting is that, of course, it's extraordinary. But you're saying that people didn't think it was particularly extraordinary.
Because everybody did it.
Because everybody did it, right?
Everybody played the piano. Everybody sang. We would get together and we would have these extraordinary choruses with just the family involved, my aunts and my uncles. Everybody sang.
That's amazing. Okay, so at what point did you begin to consider that this could be a life? Did anybody else make a life of it?
I had a cousin who I heard sing, but it was a distant cousin. There was no immediate connection. Thomas L. Thomas was a great baritone, and he sang on Bell Telephone Hour. So we watched, and I thought, this is terrific.
Yes.
And then when I was 11, the town that I come from had a talent show. And the music teacher, one Maybelle Golis, said, you have to sing, and you have to sing Somewhere Over the Rainbow. Oh, sure. Fine. So I went home and I told my mother that we have to do this. And she said, please don't.
Really?
Mm-hmm. And I said, well, why not? She said, oh, it would make me so nervous.
Oh, my.
So I said, well, I'm singing anyway. I think she was afraid that I would fail.
Yeah. I'm sure that's right, but it's so interesting. So it's interesting that she had this perspective and that you said, well, never mind, I'm going to do it anyway.
Anyway,
right,
yes.
At 11, you were already pretty headstrong.
from three.
Yes, right.
So I went, and the date got closer, and the evening came, and she said, I will give you $5 if you don't sing.
Oh, my goodness.
And I said, Mother, don't be silly. First prize is $10, and I'm singing. So we got in the truck, and we went, and I got up, and I sang, and I won.
Of course.
And everybody was like,
shocked.
Shocked. Well, everybody knew I sang, but nobody had heard me in our town of 3,000 people.
Right.
Only the farmers knew I sang. Only the cows and the farmers knew
I
sang.
I see, right.
So my mother sat there, and to hear her tell, my father said she was a wreck. And she got into a muck sweat. You know what a muck sweat is?
Well, I've heard the expression.
The only other time I had it was when I was in 1776, the original show on Broadway, and John Cullum didn't make his entrance on time. And the conductor kept on saying, "Can you sing Molasses to Rum the Slaves?" And no! The makeup rolled off me. I was drenched. The floor was drenched. Everything was drenched around me at that point.
That's a muck sweat.
That's a muck sweat. Well, my mother was in the same thing.
Oh, poor thing.
And then, but I won.
Of course.
And because of that, then everybody started to ask me to sing. And I did. And of course, at that moment, they discovered that I had an extraordinary range. I mean, really extraordinary.
Yes, yes.
I had a 4-octave range.
Yes.
And when I was 12, my voice didn't change. It shifted. So instead of having the high F above high C and the low F, it went down a fourth, and I had the high C and the low C. So I was soprano soloist in 7th grade chorus and bass soloist with the men's chorus in high school.
Oh, that's hilarious.
Well, it was, and they just didn't, no one knew how to, what to do with this.
Right, right, right.
And that was, and then I decided, after seeing, you know, we had finally had television and I saw all these wonderful shows, and I suddenly went, I want to be a singer. Mm-hmm. That was my goal. And of course, my parents, by this time my mother, I must finish that thing. I won $10 and my mother gave me $10 because she doubted me. So, and my father, I mean, we were farmers. I milked cows. I sang to the cows. That was the thing. And we just went on and did. I said, well, I'm going to be a singer. That's nice, dear.
Right. So milk the cow.
Go milk the cows.
Right.
And, but I knew that that was what I wanted to do. So I started studying with Maybelle Golis, who was a wonderful, inspirational, joyous personality.
Wow.
And then, when I was 14, other people heard me sing. By this time, I was working as a country and western yodeler also.
If it can be done with the voice,
If it can be done with the voice, I'll do it.
That's right.
So I did. And they said, well, gee, you have to be heard by other people. So I did. I entered contests, and they had this thing in high school where they would take all the musicians from the various schools. So the band would go in and you had the state auditions, and the band would go and various instruments would go, and they had a thing for solo voice. And Maybelle said, why don't you try out? And I said, well, fine. What would you like to do? And I said, well, I heard this thing, The Erl King. It was this wonderful, dramatic, played part. So you had the Erl King, who was like death, and you had the father and the little boy. Ooh. So I just went to town on this. Of course, no one told me I couldn't do it, so I did it.
Right.
And I went to Pittsburgh, and I sang, and I got an excellent in the rating. And everyone was sort of stunned, you know, because usually you weren't allowed when you were 14. A freshman in high school was not allowed to do this. But I went. I didn't know.
Yet again.
Nobody knew. So right. I went and I sang, and I got this wonderful rating. They said I would have gotten a superior, but I acted too much. Because I acted out
of all the parts, right.
I did all the parts. Right. And after that, about a month later, I got a letter from the University of Pittsburgh saying that I had won, because of my performance, a full scholarship to the University of Pittsburgh.
Oh, my God.
And I had to write back and tell them I was 14 and I wouldn't be looking for anything for another 4 years.
But wait.
But wait. All right. So then a woman by the name of Stella Warner heard me sing in my hometown. And she was a lovely woman who was from Philadelphia, and she knew, oh, what was the name of that music school? There's a very famous music school in Philadelphia. So she called and had an audition for me. And I went down, and they said, we will give you a full scholarship if you come here. And I thought, well, now that's interesting, but I don't like Philadelphia. That's not the hub of things. New York is.
Wow.
So let me see what else I could do. So on the Bell Telephone Hour, Robert Merrill sang, and Jerome Hines sang. And I sat down and I wrote a letter to Robert Merrill and Jerome Hines at the Metropolitan Opera. And I said, I am interested in taking lessons. Who's your voice teacher? Now, I am 14.
Yes. Right.
So they wrote back, and each one said, my voice teacher is Samuel Margolis of 157 West 57th Street, and here's his phone number. So I called.
Of course.
And I said, I would like to audition. And he said, well, I would be happy to hear you. This is what it requires. Where are you? I said, well, I'm on a farm in Pennsylvania. Well, you have to come to New York, and I charge for auditions. And I spoke to my parents, and they said, well, let's see what happens. So it was a big adventure. He looked at me, and he went, how old are you? And I said, well, gee, I'm 14. And he said, I don't take children.
Oh.
But since you're here, I will hear you and give you my opinion. Maybelle Golis came and played, and I sang The Earl King, and I finished. And he said, that was extraordinary. I will take you. These are the requirements. You have to come and work with me twice a week for 6 weeks, and then you can go to once a week, but you have to come at once a week.
Well, so you have to live in New York.
No. At that point, now my father had broken his back and had just recovered because I'd run the farm for 2 years in addition to other things. And they said, fine. My sister had married and I could go and stay with her in Jersey and take the train into New York and begin my studies. So I did. That was what I did for 6 weeks.
What did you do about school?
Well, it was summer.
I was off.
I was off, and my father arranged to have other people come and help milk cows and
hay. Right.
So I did that for 6 weeks, and I went back home, and I went to school, and I worked on the farm as my father's hired hand. I made my money to pay for my lessons.
Right.
And working on a farm is very hard.
I know.
And I sang scales every day.
To the cows.
To the cows.
Right.
And I sang my music to the cows, and I took bows to the cows. I did everything and acted out the parts to the cows.
Lucky cows.
And sang and sang and sang.
Well, okay, so is this how you got through high school? I mean, is this for the next 3 years or 4 years or whatever?
For the next 4 years, I went and I worked. I did my country and western yodeling and sang legit. And then when I was 18 and ready for college, Mr. Margolis said, my secretary is gone for the summer. I will hire you to come and work for me. I will give you free lessons and a salary.
Wow.
So that's what I did. I went and stayed with them. I worked. And sometimes I'd have two lessons a day because someone would miss and say, oh, come in and we'll do this.
Right.
So that was what I did. So I did that when I was 18 and 19. And then when I was 20, I was going to East Stroudsburg, the University of Stroudsburg in Pennsylvania. And we were doing a show called The Most Happy Fella. Mm-hmm. And I had been cast as Tony.
Mm.
And Tom Waring, Fred Waring's brother, came to hear me. I mean, came to the show.
Right.
He came to the show. And this man came back to see me after the show, and he said, I would like you to come to sing for my brother. And I said, well, thank you so much. Who is he?
Right.
And he said, well, he's Fred Waring. Well, I knew Fred Waring because it was Fred Waring in the Pennsylvania.
Of course, everybody did.
They had a huge television show. They did all these wonderful things. But at that point, I was running the farm again because my father was very ill. But Fred wanted to hear me. But it had to be around his golf game. So I was ready to go and sing. And I got this call from the office, and his secretary said, Mr. Waring would like to hear you today. It's raining, and they can't play golf, so will you come down? Uh-huh. And I went down with my stack of music, and I went in. And he said, well, I don't have an accompanist today, but I just want to hear you. I said, fine. Do you mind if I play the piano? So I sat down, and I could play my own things. So I sat down and I played and I sang, and he said, that's really good. I will hire you.
Good grief.
So I left college and went with Fred Waring.
Oh my God.
And I went from college and the farm to recording with Frank Sinatra and Patti Page and doing the Bell Telephone Hour and doing big tours, big national tours. It was really extraordinary.
It's extraordinary.
It was extraordinary.
So, how long did you stay with Fred Waring?
2 years.
Wow.
I was with him 2 years. And then I went to the Air Force.
Oh, dear.
And I became a singing sergeant.
Are you serious?
Yes. And then they looked at my feet one day and said, why are you here? You have flat feet and crooked heels. You can't be in the... So I said, but I'm here and I'm a sergeant. So they had a thing at that point where you could be in for a period of time and then they'd put you into something else. But I sang at the White House. I sang all over Washington. I sang. And I met some of my best friends in the world, Don Chapman, who was a baritone. And so after I left the Air Force, I went back, and I was soloist at Radio City Music Hall.
Good grief. It's like this whole thing just sort of fell into place for you.
It did. Because one thing led to another, and
yes.
Somebody would hear me and say, oh, you're really good. You know, I have a friend who needs...
Right, or I have a brother.
A job. And then while I was at the music hall, I met two more wonderful friends, Beverly Morrison and Maggie Task. And they both went, you have a terrific voice. Beverly said, you know, I'm going into The Merry Widow and starring Patrice Munsell.
Mm.
How would you like to audition? And I said, well, sure. When? Well, today I'll call Franz Ahlers and I'll call... Richard Rogers. So they called me and said, be here at 4 o'clock. So I went in and met Mr. Rogers and Franz Ahlers, and I sang. And they said, and what do you have in English? I said, well, nothing, really. I don't sing in English. But I have Il Acerato Spirito and Mein Herr und Gott. Well, oh, yes, So I sang it, and they said, you're hired. And
learn some English.
And learn some English, because we're doing it in English. And they gave me a little part in it. And I did a wonderful tour with Pat Mansell.
Wow.
And then met another fabulous friend by the name of Jeremy Ives, who was a dancer.
Mm-hmm.
He and his wife, Helen. And we, all of us, the three of us, Maggie, Beverly, and I, were buddies. And we did show after show after show. And then Maggie took me to sing for John Kenley. And I sang for John Kenley, who was one of the biggest summer stock producers. So suddenly I had a circuit.
Yes.
If I wasn't working in a Broadway show or an off-Broadway show or a national tour, I would go back to Radio City. And I'd work at Radio City, and then I'd get a call and go off. Go back on tour. And we did all kinds of things, and it was really wonderful.
And this is, what, the 50s? The 60s?
This is the 60s now.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, when, and it's really the heyday, really, of...
It was the heyday of everything.
Everything.
So I had, I knew where I was, I mean, people don't do it now, but I knew where I was I was booked two years ahead, usually. I knew that my summer stock was taken care of because of John Kenley. I knew that all of these things would be taken care of. I would pick up the phone and call. So then, while I was at John Kenley's, while I was at Radio City, there was met another wonderful friend by the name of Thalia Mazarakis, who possibly had the most gorgeous soprano voice that anyone had ever heard. Mm. And we would go off on these tours. Don Chapman, Thalia Mazarakis, myself. we would go and we would tour for John Kenley and do show after show after show.
It's a lovely life.
It was fabulous.
Yeah.
It was fabulous. And then I was doing, let me see, the De Cormier Singers, which was a wonderful, very avant-garde. They did all kinds of music, but it was just a wonderful tour. And while I was on that tour, I came down with hepatitis.
Ah.
A dread disease. And I was out for a year.
How old were you?
I think I was 29. 30. I must have been 30.
And you were out for a year?
I was out for a year. I had it to the point of death.
Did you?
I did.
Were you hospitalized? Or you
for 3 months.
Jesus.
In Rimouski, Ontario.
Oh, how nice.
And people there only spoke French. Now, my French, I had high school French, and I had some college French. But when they say, you know, and they're saying, do you, désirez-vous do? But they're saying it so fast, you know, do, a dear. No, can't be that. And they're saying, do you want water? Well, I'd love some water, but I don't have the strength to lift the glass. So I was there for a long time. So when I got out of there and went back to the farm,
oh, to recuperate.
To recuperate. My father would take me on the tractor to wherever he was working. And he would help me off the tractor, and I would sit in the dirt. I know this sounds peculiar, but we were farmers, and we believed in the earth.
Yes.
So I would sit and put my hands in the dirt and sit there for hours while he did whatever he was doing.
Mother Earth.
Mother Earth. And then he would come and get me and would on the tractor and would go back. And by that time, my mother would be home from work. So the three of us would walk down to the house. Now, my father had his left leg removed.
Oy.
At one thing. I mean, we still ran a farm and we had cattle, but he had his left leg removed. My mother was crippled with her hip. So we're walking down the street, and I looked at both of them, and I said, well, here we are, the lame, the halt, and the blind, because my glasses were like pop bottles, and I wasn't wearing my contact lenses at that moment. So I'm sitting there in the garden one day, and my grandmother said, you have a phone call. Well, who is it? It's City Opera. Will you please come back and sing at the opera. We need you. We're doing not the glagolitic mass, but it was one of those things by Janacek. And they needed somebody that had a low C sharp. So I said, all right. So I went back and I sang that. It was a lot of work because I still wasn't well. But I got through it and I did it. And I decided to go back to college and get my degree.
Oh, because you'd interrupted it.
I'd interrupted
to go to work.
It, yes,
right.
To go to work.
Mm-hmm.
So I did. I went back to school at East Stroudsburg, and I got my degree in voice production. And I think I had three other majors or four other majors. I had an English major and a history major and a theater arts major and a voice production major. And there may have been a reading major in there, I'm not sure. I think I had 150 credits. because I'd take 18 hours and then I'd take 20 hours. I mean, I like to read.
Yes.
And then I'd take 22 hours. And they'd go, I think you're doing too many things.
But they didn't understand that you actually can.
Yeah, well, I did, and I loved it. I loved to read, and I could really do it. No math, but I could read.
Right.
So at the end of that, I went back to New York, and they had an audition for Jesus Christ Superstar. And I had a friend, Harrison Fisher, with whom I had worked in Merry Widow, who was a fantastic writer and conductor. And he said, they're doing this audition and you've got to go. Everybody has to learn. I don't know how to love him.
Jesus.
I will pick the key. So when you go in and they say, what key are you doing it? You say this. So I did. And I went in and I sang. And they called me back.
Hmm.
And I went in and I sang the second time. And then there was an announcement in the paper that they'd lost their backers and it would be no more. It was down the tubes. So a few months later, an announcement, they had a new backer. I thought, well, I'll go in again and do it. So I went in and I sang. I got a call back. And they said, announcement in the paper, they've lost their backer. So a few months later, a new announcement. We were doing it. And I said, I'm not going. I'm just not going. This is foolish. And I got a phone call.
Where are you?
Where are you? We want you to come in.
Right.
And I said, well, all right. So I went in and I sang. And I got a call back. And then I got another call back. And then, I wish I could remember the man's name who was casting director. He was phenomenal, and he wrote a very successful book on how to audition.
Mm.
And he was really a nice man, and he said, look, we're looking for someone to come into 1776, and I'd like you to come in. And I said, well, I don't really sing in English. The only thing I know in English is I don't know how to love him. And he said, that's fine, just come in and sing. So I went in and I sang, oh, thank you very much. Now read, oh, thank you very much. And I went home, and they called me from Jesus Christ Superstar. Would you come in? And they said, well, now we need you to sight read. Sight read, are you kidding? Well, here's the music. And it was the part of Caiaphas, or Caiaphas, however one wants to say it. So I sight read that because it goes from an F sharp down to a low C or C sharp. It's low. It's all over the place. Fine. I did that. Well, now you have to fly. Oh, God. And I hate heights. So the stagehand took me into the proscenium where they put me on a little square.
Oh, dear.
With no
railing.
No railing. You were hooked on a belt which hooked on the railing behind you. And I turned to the man and I said, I can't do this. He said, sure you can. Hook. He said, you have to let go of me so we can lower this down. And I said, all right.
So
you have to let go with your other hand. No, now let go with the other hand. No, now let go with the other hand. Because each time I let go, I would grab another hand. Would come up. And he went, I said, I can't do this. I just can't.
Right.
All right. Well, we'll think of something. So they lowered me down. That night, I get a call from Jesus Christ Superstar, and 1776, within 5 minutes of each other offering me the part of Joseph Hughes in 1776, and Caiaphas in Jesus Christ Superstar. And I said, without a moment's hesitation, I'll do 1776. Thank you so much.
Yes. They don't want me to fly.
I don't want to fly. But that was an experience, because on my first, within the first 2 weeks, John Cullum left me alone on stage, which I told you.
Yes, right.
And I was in this muck sweat. But I did it for about a year as a replacement. And it was a wonderful, one of the most wonderful experiences. Each thing was a wonderful experience.
Yeah, your life is full of them.
Yes.
Yeah, it's like you're bouncing from one wonderful experience to another.
And then, let me see what happened. Well, then after that, it was show after show and tour and Canadian Opera. And then I got a call for to audition for Giancarlo Menotti.
Good grief.
For the Spoleto Festival. And I went in and I sang. And they hired me to do the chef in The Egg, which was a Menotti opera, and the sheriff in Martin's Lie. And I had 15 minutes of fame.
Oh, really?
I did. Personal things. By that time, I had had... Something went wrong with my voice.
Uh-oh.
And I didn't know what it was. And I was with Canadian Opera at the time, and I was doing Basilio in Barber of Seville. And suddenly it was so effortful to sing, what is wrong? My high notes weren't... I could do them, but they were pushed and shoved.
I know this
and
one.
I went, oh, God, what's wrong? And I went back to New York because I'd been hired because they wanted a low C in the Easter show at the Music Hall. And luckily we recorded so that you could sing and you could sing to yourself so it sounded like more than 12 people. It would be a choir of 24. And suddenly I lost my low notes, and then I lost my high notes. And I went to a doctor, and he said, well, there seems to be a blockage in your sinus. I will we'll fix it, we'll flush it out. Well, he picked up a thing about a foot and a half long,
mm-hmm.
like a big needle, a hollow tube, and picked it up and put
it in
my nose. And then took a hammer and drove it into my
no,
sinuses.
No.
And attached water and started this pump. I cleared his office in about 2 minutes because I screamed so severely. And he pulled it out. He never sent me a bill, by the way.
Well, he's not a fool.
And he said, I don't think I can help you. But he didn't say what to do, and I staggered out of there. It was, I mean, the pain was horrific. I went to Joan Dorneman, who was my coach at the time. She's a coach at the Met. Very nice. And she said, I will call Dr. Gould. So I went to Dr. Gould, and he said, young man, you have a tumor in your submaxillary sinus. Now, I already had the job at the Spoleto Festival, and this suddenly crunched on very rapidly. Within 2 months, all of this horror happened. So I went in and I had the operation, and they did what was called a Caldwell lock, where they cut your face off, basically. They cut your upper lip around, peel the skin back over your head, and chisel out your cheekbone. And he said, you should think about canceling
Spoleto,
because if we do this operation, you may never sing again. And I said, doctor, do the operation. I will sing.
Oh, dear.
So they went in. They did the operation. I came out. Thinking back on it, the nurse, I had to stand up because it's one of my things. I must stand up after an operation. When I come out of the things, I have to stand up. So she's saying, you know, just be easy, stand up, stand up. Well, suddenly I was ill, and I vomited quarts of blood over this poor woman. It looked like an axe murder had taken place in my little hospital room. It was just the most extraordinary thing, and I thought, well, this doesn't look
good.
This
isn't good, right?
This must not be good.
This doesn't bode well. Right.
So, but I got through it. They took out a mile of packing. They did all this stuff. 5 days later, I was at the Spoleto Festival, ready to sing.
Wow.
And I went in and I sang. And it was one of the most wonderful things, because Giancarlo Menotti was one of the people, as a director, who would say, tell me how you view this role. Mm-hmm. Tell me about what you think. Tell me about what you would like to do. Now, some of the people in the cast didn't know what he wanted, and so he would coach them through things. And I said, oh, really? This is what I'd like to do. I'd like to do this here and that there. Now, can I change some of the notes in this? Because I'd like to flip up a 2-octave jump to do a high note, and can I speak this, and can I do that? Because I would go, and it sliced, thin, thin, thin! You know, it was that kind of thing. And he said, oh, yes, that's wonderful. And here we are with the Sheriff in Martin's Lie. What would you like to do? And I said, well, can I show you this one thing? The boy's name was Sean Coombs, if I remember. He was wonderfully talented, the little boy. And the basic plot is an escapee convinces the young man who was in an orphanage that he is his father, and to let him hide from the sheriff and get out. He's the Count of Anjou, I think, or one of those things. And he does. And the sheriff knows the man is there and is going to torture the kid and tells him all these things. But at this one moment on stage, and it's written to take place in a church, I said to the little boy, I said, Sean, look, please trust me. I'm wearing a cloak. And we have been far along in rehearsal now. I said, when I grab you by your costume, reach your hands up and grab my wrist, because I'm going to turn and pick you up. And don't let go, and don't be frightened. I will not let go of you, but for added help, you hold on to me. So we are on the lip of the stage, the lip of the stage. The orchestra is 35 feet or 40 feet in the back of the church. There is no one close. And I grabbed him, this is rehearsal, and I grabbed him, and I said, now let yourself go. Just let yourself go limp. And he had very long blonde hair. And I turned, because a soldier had said, sung something to me. And I turned, and facing the other way, and he was over this, like, 10-foot drop. And he was hanging, and his hair hanging down, and his little feet hanging. You couldn't see him because the cloak covered part of it, so you didn't see the grip.
Right.
When we got, and Menotti said, oh my God, you've got to keep that. So we did, and on our opening night, when we did that, I turned and I did this thing, and the entire audience went, there was this gasp. No one could believe what was happening. There was another part where I was to turn and signal to a soldier to go and get the torturer, you know, the head executioner, who was this massive black man who was so sweet and kind, but they had him muscled and rigged and, you know, carrying irons and all kinds of things. And I turned to signal the soldier, and there was no one there. Not a soul. Not a soul. And I went, okay, keep singing. Wave your hand.
Do something.
And pretend it will all come out all right. Mm-hmm. And I kept singing. And then out of the corner of my eye, the torturer came. Oh, thank you, Jesus. But it scared me out of my wits. But at the end of the show, when it was time for bows, I got hisses and screams. And, of course, I repented and I had tears rolling down my eyes at the end. But my mother said, I couldn't believe you were that mean. I couldn't believe you were my son. But Menotti was wonderful. I've been lucky to work with some great directors. And each one that I loved, certain ones wanted certain things, but the best ones wanted to see what you brought to it. What was your idea?
Yeah.
How did you view this? What do you think?
They weren't arrogant.
No, no. They wanted what you could bring.
Well, they
to
wanted
it.
What was best.
Yes.
You know, they were open to whatever
yes.
would make it the best.
And so years pass, as it were. I do a lot of opera, and I did. And one day, John O'Connor said, they're auditioning for Phantom of the Opera, and you've got to go. I said, John, I have a huge teaching schedule. I have nearly 60 students. I can't leave and do a tour. He said, you've got to. I said, well, I'm not. So I can't remember what day it was, but John called and said, I've signed you up, and you have to be here. I'm coming for you. Just cancel your student. So he made me go to this audition, which I didn't want to go to. And I went in, and they said they wanted to hear something in English. Well, I knew because I had done Barber of Seville so many times. I knew La Coluna, and I knew it in English. So I said, all right, I'll do it in English. And I got in there, and because they were going through things about, oh, we'll sing this in Italian. And you could hear them through the doors at Equity. So I went in, and I said, you have a choice. I can either sing this aria, La Coluna, from Barber of Seville, in English or in Italian. What would you like? Well, the woman said English, and the man said Italian. So they did it back and forth, and they finally said, well, just do it in English. And I started, let me tell you, I am Venticello, Onoretta, the art of slander. And I broke myself up, and I laughed, and I said, well, thank you so much. I have to go home now. And I reached for my music, and they said, stop. Don't do that. You have to come in. We want you there on Thursday. And I said, well, actually, I can't because I'm going to sing at the Berlin Opera on Thursday. I'm with La Grande Chaîne, and we're booked for this thing in Berlin. And I just can't do that. So goodbye, thanks. They said, no, no, you have to come in. You must come in. We will rearrange. So they got on their phones, and they said, oh, no, no, no. Can you come in on Tuesday? I said, well, all right. Oh, this is a Monday. Yes, it is a Monday. And I said, yes, I can be there. I can be there. No, I'm sorry. It's a Wednesday. This is Monday, the audition. So I run to my coach, Donald Myers, who's a fabulous coach in New York. And I said, Donald, I have to pull this together because I really screwed up. I didn't know if I was doing it in English or what I was doing it in. I did it English and Italian. And he said, it's fine. So we worked it out. Because I've always found if you're doing an important audition, take your own accompanist
yes.
so you know what's really happening. So I went to the Majestic Theater, interestingly enough, where I had done 1776, and went in, and they were ready for me. And I went in and I said to the stage manager, can I have this chair? Because I have found, whenever I audition, I do the whole thing. If I'm singing something, I know where the people are. I act it out. I do everything. It's a performance. It's not an audition. It's a performance. So he said, well, yeah. So I drag the chair on stage, put down, I sit down, and I nod to Donald, and I do. Let me tell you the art of slander, so elusive you scarcely feel it. Not a motion will reveal it. Kill it gently, oh so gently. Almost imperceptibly begins to grow. Hand goes up. I said, okay. I get up. And from the back we hear, you're perfect. And it was Hal Prince.
Oh, my God.
He said, you're hired. You're perfect for the second time. And I said, but you haven't heard the high note. He said, I know it's there. I said, you haven't heard the low note. I know it's there. So suddenly I left for Berlin to sing. I came back. I did... We did Kennedy Center, and then we came back, also La Grande Chaîne, and then we were at a wonderful Spanish tapas bar on 28th Street, and I'm in rehearsal for Phantom of the Opera. And I did that for 3 years, and it was wonderful. The people were wonderful. Wow. It was a wonderful experience.
You know, you didn't say how you got into teaching.
Well, I always taught.
Oh.
Because when I'd come back from Mr. Margolis when I was 14, and a number of the other kids around me said, what did you learn? Well, this is what I learned. Sing this. No, mia, mia. No, get it to the front. Up here. Breath moves to the front. Breath moves first, voice on top. Breath moves first, voice on top. So I started then.
Okay, I only ask one other question.
Okay.
And that is, having given a life, and you really have, I mean, from three till now, to singing, to music, to performing, to teaching, all about music, is there anything that you would say about what it was like to live a life dedicated to music and performing?
I think I am the luckiest person in the world. I have had the happiest life. I mean, yes, there are ups and downs and high drama and angst and fright, but I have had the most wonderful life of anybody that I could ever imagine. All of my students, I had 33 people on Broadway at one point. I've taken people who couldn't sing and gotten them pitch and rhythm and taught them how to do it, and they've gotten Broadway shows and done very well. Timothy, my partner, and I had been together for... Timothy was always there through all of these years. Timothy Gray wrote High Spirits with Hugh Martin, and we were together through all of this Sturm und Drang of my life. Timothy... And my life was the most exciting. There were always plans. There were always shows. There was always activity. There was always things that were going on. Everything was an adventure.
Yeah.
It was really wonderful.
And it's particularly extraordinary because of where you come from.
Yes.
I mean, this farm boy thing, you know, to the toast of Broadway and opera and...
Well, not exactly the toast.
Well, but yeah.
But it's been fabulous. And now I have great students.
Well, we're lucky to have
them. And I'm lucky to be here.
A great place to start. Thank you very much, Carl.
Oh, thank you.
So there you have it. A man who always knew who he was, knew from the time he was three that he was a singer. And he held on to that, even at the risk of his mother's nervousness, even though on a dairy farm, nobody really thought of this as a career. he knew in his soul, in his bones, in himself, that this was who he was, and he continued to pursue it and to follow it. And, well, you heard the story. He had the most extraordinary life. Even with its ups and downs, with its illnesses, with its disappointments, he still can say he had the most extraordinary life he could imagine, and that he's a lucky guy. And we are lucky, both to have him as a role model, to be able to listen to this and to hear what it sounds like when you grab your life by the horns and then hold on tight, and for any of us who have had the experience of working with Carlo. So if you want voice lessons, or you want anything to do with music or your voice, come on down to Sarasota. I'm sure he'll make room for you. So I don't have any time, of course, just enough time to thank Josh Hackney, who saves my life over and over again. That is my radio life and my recording life and my electronic life and my computer life and all those lives. And if you want Josh or you want me, you want to hear this interview again or any of the other interviews that I've done, if you want to hear about my book, if you want to hear the first chapter of my book, When You Can, You Will, anything that has to do with me, you can find all of that on my website, thelynnshow.com, thelynne, don't leave the E out of Lynn, show, thelynnshow.com. As always, I hope you got something you can use from this show, something that inspired you or something that just tickled you, but something that'll bring you back, because I will be back next week, same time, same station, and as always, I hope you will be too.
You see, I'm getting older. My hair is turning gray. Oh, you see my face and figure I won't see days. Well, I won't be retiring. I won't slip out of sight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I like some goddamn boomerang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. You see that I have had my shot. My time has come and gone. Oh, won't I please get off the stage? Let someone else get on. Well, I won't be relegated or leave without a fight. No, I will not go gentle into that good night. I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Life's a bell I keep on ringing, not a chime that I once rang. You may think it's unseemly. Well, I don't give a dang. No, I won't go with a whimper. I am going with a bang. Rising from the ashes every chance I get. I may be running out of time, but it ain't over yet. 'Cause me and Sister Phoenix, we won't give up the flight. No, no, we will not go gentle into that good night. And I won't go with a whimper. I'm going with a bang. Life's a song I keep on singing, not a tune that I once sang. I may not be as juicy, Phil, but I still got some tang.